Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello, welcome. Joining me today to share the 10 best spiritual books that influenced him the most is researcher, speaker, and author of numerous titles on Christian mysticism and spirituality, Paul Anthony Wallace. A former senior churchman, theological educator, archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia, and lecturer on the history of religious thought and hermeneutics, Paul Wallace's journey from church minister to best-selling author of a revelationary trilogy of books, questioning whether humanity has confused the idea of God with memories of ET contact, has been far from what most people, including himself, would have predicted. Paul Wallace, welcome.
G'day, Sandy. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Good. Thank you for compiling your list for us. And a very interesting one it is too. Before we start, the life you're living now is a long way from the life you were living during your 33 years in ministry. You were a theological educator. You designed training packages for Pentecostal pastors in the UK. Your subjects were the history of Christian thought and the principles of hermeneutics. And today your books, interviews, and documentaries probing world mythologies and ancestral narratives for their insights into human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos, read and viewed by millions of people worldwide. What do you think when you look back over that incredible transition?
Well, it has been an incredible transition because I would not have predicted the subject matter that I'm now talking about a few years ago. It's been a taboo busting experience for myself, as well as for my readers and viewers. But in some ways, my ministry now bears a lot of similarities with my ministry before, when I was in more mainstream church-based ministry. All my pastoral work is done one-to-one, mainly through video formats like this. But what it's about is still very much about the same thing, where I'm connecting with people in transition, people who are in a life transition, people who've had an experience that they can't understand and are needing to process. So that aspect of it is really very, very similar. And in that and in the writing, I really feel I'm still doing what I've always done, which is essentially to be on a learning journey and to share the journey. And I've been surprised by how similar the work is now to what it was even a decade ago, even though I'm connecting with people for very, very different reasons. And the reasons I'm connecting with them have nothing to do with the machinations of the world of church.
Yeah. I mean, and it was quite a quick transition in many respects. I would think that looking at your book list, you know, I mean, you don't often come across, people tend to grow gradually and change, you know, what they're reading and expand and evolve as they go. But I would imagine that your literature changed dramatically.
Yes, it did really. I don't know what my list looks like to another person. I can see a continual evolution of thought and a continual deconstruction and reconstruction of my worldview. But then, yes, there's a very accelerated period of change of thought from about, Probably the last 9 years it sped up, and then it sped up again about 5 years ago. And it's real roller coaster riding stuff the last few years as I've made fresh discoveries for myself, processed it, thought it through, joined the dots. The incredible thing is that my wife has made the exact same intellectual journey as myself, but completely independently. For me, this rapid learning phase was kicked off by a period of R&R after a very tough work assignment and probing the texts of the Bible with my translation tools. That was my way in to what I'm doing now. Whereas with Ruthie, she just started watching YouTube videos of people describing their near-death experiences. That was her white rabbit. And with my different white rabbit, we found out we had arrived in the same rabbit warren.
That's good.
Period. Month by month, I'd tentatively say to Ruth, do you know, I'm beginning to think this. And she'd say, oh my goodness, that's exactly what I've been thinking the last week or so. That's all that's been on my mind. And this just went on month after month. And we realized we were both on this track of accelerated relearning. It was an amazing experience.
I bet it was, because you hear about so many couples where one is and the other isn't. And then, you know, things have to change.
Yes, it can pull people apart for sure.
So tell me, when I asked you to compile this list, was it difficult? Was it a challenge? I mean, you've read more than most people, and you've, you know, read in a particular, you know, direction. How difficult was it?
Well, it was difficult because I have read a lot of books that I've loved, and I tried to do my top 10 books list a couple of years ago for my own website, and the shortest list I could get to was 22. So it was a real challenge narrowing it down to 10, but I think these are probably the 10 biggest mind-changing books that I've read.
And the very first one, in a sense, is very applicable to what you're doing now. And you say this is the book that really, you know, sparked your lifelong learning quest. It is Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken, which you came out in 1969. When did you come across it?
I came across it in 1976 as a very young man, as a schoolboy. And I was curious. I had a curious mind on me, and my parents were very good at encouraging that. I now realize, looking back, at the time, I always perceived my parents as very conservative, as most kids do, of course. But my mum occasionally would buy me books to encourage me in my curiosity. She bought me a wonderful book, The World Atlas of Mysteries, with all sorts of things about the pyramids and cryptids and Velikovsky and all sorts of anomalous stories like that. And then this was a book that my parents actually owned, Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods. They had a copy that was on the top of the pile of magazines in our living room. So it was clearly a book to be dipped into continually, of perpetual interest. And they had a dinner party one day, and I think it was a lunch, actually a Sunday lunch, where they'd invited some friends of theirs. It must have been friends from Dad's work, and they were talking about Chariots of the Gods, because it was, I think, the movie had only just happened, or they'd screened the movie on the BBC or something like that, so everyone was talking about it once again. And my brother Mark and I were very lucky to be invited to this grown-up dinner party my parents had thrown, and we kept up with the adult conversation, and my ears pricked up when I heard what they were talking about. It got me to read the book. I loved what I was reading, because I had always felt that what I was being taught at school, by way of an explanation for the human race, who we are, how we got here, I felt there were all sorts of holes in what I was being told. The religious answer just seemed to be really lazy. The reason we're here and we're at the top of the tree is because God wanted it that way. We're his special creation. Well, that's lovely. Special creation. How come it's so obvious that we're a type of primate then? We're clearly one of the animals. Wouldn't we be more different? And how did we get to the top of the tree exactly? We're so different to all the other animals. And that never quite seemed to get explained. And then evolutionary theory, there seemed to be a gap in that as well, because the only reason we're at the top of the tree is because of our higher level of consciousness, our higher level of intelligence. If you or I, Sandy, were left out in the wild, probably after 3 days, three nights, we'd either be sick or hospitalized, or we might have passed away. We're not very well adapted to life on this planet unless we can light a fire, unless we have a weapon, unless we can build a shelter. So where does the intelligence for that come from? There was a gap. And I felt that Eric von Daniken had very aptly put his finger on that problem and said there's a gap in our ability to explain ourselves, and then suggested that our story of development would make more sense if we allowed for the possibility of external interventions to assist our development. And I thought, yes, that makes perfect sense. And then his book is full of evidences for contact in the deep past. And some of them, at least, I thought, all right, either he's right or there's some other explanation I've yet to discover for this very interesting story. And it started my quest because it didn't answer the ultimate question of where everything came from. If we were seeded by other life, where did that life come from? If we were aided by other intelligence, where did that intelligence come from? It pushed the cause further out into the cosmos, but where does it end? And it was those questions that really led to my becoming a Christian. And I started a quest that has continued from that day to this. And it was Eric von Daniken who kicked me off on that journey.
I think I must have read it around about the same year. And I remember just not knowing how much to believe, but being absolutely tantalized by, you know, all of the thoughts that unfolded, all of the questions, you know, that followed it, as you say. And I think it was the first one for me.
Let me say a quick PS, because exactly how much of it to believe? And a lot of people will say, oh, look, most of that's been debunked, hasn't it? So half of his evidences were all over the place. And Carl Sagan came along and convinced me of that, that I could just put all that to one side. He famously debunked Eric von Daniken's theory by saying that the chances of us being nurtured by another species or even hybridized with was as likely as you and I hybridizing with a petunia. Ha, ha, ha. End of story. Well, if Carl Sagan, you know, the ultimate intellect of the moment, thinks this is rubbish, it must be rubbish. Of course, now we know a little bit more about genetic modification, the petunia joke doesn't work anymore because you can splice all sorts of DNA. But what I didn't know is that Carl Sagan secretly agreed with Eric von Daniken. Mm. It was just not the ticket on which he was doing business. And when I discovered that, which was about 5 years ago, I thought, I need to go back to Eric von Daniken and give him a second hearing, because if Carl Sagan secretly agreed with him but just didn't think he could say so in public, then there's something here to look at.
Yeah. And isn't that true of so many? I know Rupert Sheldrake, some of his peers who are very good at hammering him privately. You know, it's a different story.
Yes. That's right.
Cowards.
Well, I got to ask Eric von Daniken about exactly this pattern, because I said to him, doesn't it frustrate you when people come to you and say, you know, secretly, I agree with you, I just can't say that in public, or here's some information that confirms your theory, just don't tell anyone it came from me. And Eric said, no, it doesn't frustrate him, because it's the role of the writer to push the conversation forward. And people with tenure are very unlikely to be the people who push the thought onto radical new territory because of the pressure of peer review and wanting to keep their job, so on and so forth. And he said if he shamed people for coming to him that way, he wouldn't get half the information that he gets. And that is just how it works. And I thought, well, if he can come to terms with it, then I think I can.
Well, also a little bit of contention, you know, is quite good for stirring up the publicity, isn't it?
Sure. You want a conversation, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So book number two is The 62nd Christian by Gary R. Collins, published in 1984. How do you become a Christian in 60 seconds?
Well, he got the title from the one-minute manager. And the idea of the book is here are some, we would call them hacks today, hacks that you can do in a 60-second window that will make real your life of discipleship as a Christian. That's the idea of the book. And it's a very thin book, very simple little book. And what blew me away, my friend Phil Steer gave me the book in 1986. He got it from a Christian bookshop in Bristol. He had read it and he said, oh, this is amazing, Paul, you must have it. And I loved the book because it boils things down into such simplicity, not in a simplistic way, but in a profound way. And, you know, in any group of people, and Christians are no exception, we develop all sorts of jargon and in-house assumptions, and we can overcomplicate things ridiculously. Whereas this book just seemed to clear away all the clutter and nonsense, get right to the heart of things, and talk about what does a 60-second worship look like? What does a 60-second prayer look like? What does 60-second evangelism look like? And I was in awe of the clarity and simplicity of the thought and the language. And then when I realized this had come from somebody with a PhD, Gary R. Collins, I was even more impressed. And I thought, if someone with a PhD in psychology can communicate as simply and clearly that a child could pick this up and understand it, and they'd be understanding really deep things, well, that's a skill really worth aspiring to. And it was that more than anything that I took away from that book, because I thought if he can do it, then I should be able to do it. And I shouldn't think more highly of myself if I can sound more educated or sound more credible than he does, because that's not the point. The point is communication. And that was the challenge that that book left me with.
I'm always in awe of people who can sum something up so succinctly, you know, and so elegantly that you just, you know, the brain stops for a minute to take
yes,
it in.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
And, you know, books like, you know, The Four Agreements, I think, you know, those simple four agreements, they're just, as you say, they're so profound that you just can't argue with them.
That's absolutely right. There was an archbishop, Michael Ramsey, a long time ago now, half a century ago now, he was Archbishop of Canterbury. And he said, if you find you can't explain a particular thing to a child, then maybe you haven't fully understood it.
Mm.
And I think that's a really great Occam's razor challenge there.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. So book number three is School for Prayer by Metropolitan Antony, 1989. That was published. Metropolitan, was that his real name?
Well, that's his title.
Ah.
So that means he's a very senior bishop in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So
okay.
he was like the archbishop in charge of the Russian Orthodox Church in exile in Britain. And so you can't get higher than that in the Russian Orthodox Church in the UK. Again, an academic, fascinating man, writing on prayer. I was given the book just before I went to theological college. And again, it was a book that blew me away with its simplicity. But there was a realness to it when he talked about prayer that I had never come across before. And I was thinking, what has he got that is so different to all the other writers? And I noticed that as well as quoting the Bible in his book, he quoted some other names I'd never heard of. Strange names, John of the Ladder, Dmitry of Rostov, people I had never heard of before. And I thought, oh, I wonder if those sources give a clue as to how he's got what he's got. And so he sent me on a journey of chain reading. I had to read now the books of all the people that he'd quoted. And that completely changed my perception of Christianity, because up until that point, I lived in a world where nobody knew what the time was until the Reformation. And there was no Christianity prior to that. It could all be discarded. And then the Reformers got it right. And then we, the evangelicals, were their descendants. And now all of a sudden, I was swimming in a much bigger ocean and realizing it was a much longer picture. It made me realize that I'd grown up in a very particular strand within Christianity, and that Christianity was really this great kaleidoscope of ideas and experiences. And so he sent me on another lifelong journey as well. And after a couple of years of thinking through the implications of what I'd read in Metropolitan Antony, I'd written a book to process the journey for myself and share the journey with others. And it was just one of those poetic moments that usually only happen in movies, where he phoned me up from out of the blue, and my boarder took the call and he handed the phone to me, almost shaking in awe. He said, "It's the Met." "What do you mean the Met?" "Metropolitan Antony." And it was Metropolitan Antony calling to say he loved the book and congratulations. And I was thrilled with that, because I thought this is a wonderful affirmation, because it means I have expressed in a way he recognizes the implications of all the material that I've been reading and digesting over the last few years. And it was a real encouragement to keep going on that track.
Well, I know that you, hermeneutics, which is what the principles of interpretation.
That's
is that
right.
Correct? Yeah.
That's right.
And you also seem to know an awful lot about root words, the roots of the, you know, the words that we take for granted. Metropolitan today has, you know, a particular meaning as far as we're concerned. What did it used to have? What's the root of it? How did it come to be applied to somebody in that position?
Well, there's a beautiful word right in the middle of metropolitan, which is people. So it's about a gathering of people, and a metropolitan is a particular size and structure of gathering of people. So that's where all that comes from. And so it's very related to how we use it in English when we have metropolitan districts, for instance. It's a district of a certain size that has a structure of jurisdiction over it. So it's somewhat similar in the world of orthodoxy, that he was a person with a jurisdiction, but his jurisdiction was the size of Great Britain.
Wow. You seem to like the Russians. Book four is The Russian Mystics, Sergius Bolshakov, published in 1976.
Well, having encountered Metropolitan Antony, I reckon there may be some otherwise Russian people. And sure enough, there are, and have been for a long time. So I picked that book up in, was it Ladbroke Grove? There's a little community called the Fellowship of St. Alban and St. Sergius, which exists to promote amity, concord among Anglicans and Orthodox. And so they have this little retreat house. People go there, they go to seminars, lectures, they go on retreats there. And I went on one of those, a weekend retreat, had a wonderful time, again, having my world expanded. And I felt I needed something to take home from the retreat to anchor the experience, to help me remember it, and to continue my learning journey. And I thought, oh, this is great, this book, because it's got about a dozen of these names I didn't know and a summary of their stories. So this is like buying a dozen books. So that was the book I chose, Russian Mystics by Sergius Bolshakov. And in that book, I discovered one of my spiritual soulmates, Saint Seraphim of Sarov, who was a Russian mystic who lived from 1759 to 1833. And reading his story in that book was extraordinary because I recognized the kind of ministry he had, which was what you could call prophetic ministry, remote viewing, clairvoyance, clairsentience, all these amazing phenomena, healing, would attend his ministry. And I recognized a lot of that from my experience in charismatic Christianity, because a lot of those experiences were being discovered in a fresh way at the time when I became a Christian. But I saw Seraphim do these things, and I thought, well, how did he get into this? Because that wasn't what Russian Orthodoxy looked like in the 1800s. Where did he get it from? And so I started reading his story, and it was absolutely life-changing what I discovered there. And then a curious PS, when I was reading the words of Seraphim, because we've got his actual words that have been recorded by friends of his, I was hearing them in the voice of the assistant pastor at the first church that I went to. And there was something very similar about their attitudes, their way of thinking, their way of speaking. So a few years later, the assistant pastor from that church was visiting my theological college. And I said to him, he was there for a rest. And so I said to him one afternoon when he was trying to have a rest, Barry, have you ever heard of a guy called Seraphim of Sarov? And his face lit up. And he said, that is the person who changed my life and introduced me to the things of the spirit. Because Barry had this amazing ability in precognition, remote viewing, clairsentience, all those things, ministry of healing. And he'd learned it from Seraphim, even though Seraphim had died in 1833. And he'd learned it by reading a little book called Russian Mystics by Sergius Bolshakov. And so I was right to make that connection. It was life-changing in that moment because I could see that Barry's life had been changed by encountering someone in the great cloud of witnesses, someone who had long predeceased him, and yet that contact was so powerful it had redefined Barry's ministry. And again, that encouraged me to continue my journeys of exploration, believing that I would find not just information, but things that could change my life as well.
Wow. Book number 5, not talking to God, not conversations with God, but listening to God. Joyce Huggett, published in 1986.
Well, God bless Joyce Huggett. She was an amazing leader and teacher at a time in evangelical Christian history when women were not really allowed much of a role. They couldn't be church leaders, and in a lot of churches, they couldn't even be teachers. But Joyce Huggett wrote books that changed the thinking of millions. And a lot of people my age might remember Joyce Huggett for having written books about relationships, boy-girl relationships, and all the do's and don'ts for Christian believers. And so a lot of people look back on those books and say, oh, they're so dated and they were so conservative and I'm embarrassed that I read them now. That's the sort of thing I hear. But her big contribution to the history of Christian thought had nothing to do with those books, had to do with this book, Listening to God. And this was after she'd built up her name as a writer. People bought it because they wanted the next Joyce Huggett book. And then their world was blown open, because she was plugging herself into ancient traditions, just as I was, and she was doing it as an evangelical leader, surreptitiously through writing books. And again, the implication was that Christianity wasn't invented at the time of the Reformation, and that those of us in the evangelical stream were only in a narrow part of the picture. And she again introduced the reader to everything that went before, and this huge, wide spectrum of teaching and experience and theology and practice that had been part of Christianity for centuries. And the book was about really how to connect with God in an experiential way. So it wasn't just about ideas and thoughts and theology and dogma. It was how to have an experience of God that was so real that you could learn and hear things from the divine that would be real enough that they were things you could do something about them. So it's called Listening to God. And so she was plugging evangelical and charismatic believers back into a much bigger, wider, deeper tradition. And I think more than anybody in the 20th century, she redefined what evangelicalism could mean and changed it from being this very narrow, dogmatic, we already know everything kind of faith to being something far more open and exploratory.
Book number six. We're going to change the pace up now. This is My Dinner with Andre. It's the 1981 screenplay. Andre Gregory, film director, playwright, and the actor and playwright Wallace Shawn having a conversation. And I think many people have seen clips from this. I think about a few years ago, they were everywhere on Facebook. Because people were suddenly saying, hang on a minute, when was this filmed? They're talking about today.
Yes, that's the power of it. It was a really prophetic screenplay. And I'm never far from my copy of it. It's such a precious thing to me. Yes, 1981, it came out. I saw it in 1984. And it's a very unlikely hit, because if you don't know it, I mean, there's the cover. That's all that happens in the movie in that one photograph right there. Two people sitting at a dinner table having a conversation. And I say having a conversation, but the wonderful Wallace Shawn, all he says for most of the movie is, what? Really? Did that really happen? That's incredible. And that's his lines. And then it's Andre Gregory who has all the other lines where he's talking about this profound experience, a midlife crisis, a reframing of his worldview, a prophetic eye now on society and what's happening in the world of theatre is most of what they're talking about. I mean, it just sounds so niche and so obscure. But as you say, Sandy, people today are saying, wait a minute. What that conversation is about, we are seeing it happen before our very eyes. We are seeing our culture do all the things this book talked about a generation ago. I mean, what, 40 years ago? And it's that prophetic prescience in the book that's made it more and more powerful with every passing year. So I surprised myself by sitting through the whole movie, wrapped. I think it was shown on Channel 4 when Channel 4 was first started in the UK, the alternative, you know, TV channel. And I just watched open mouthed, initially because I couldn't believe the format, and then because I knew profound truths were being spoken that just sat with me for the next 40 years. It had another impact on me as well, because Seraphim of Sarov, who I mentioned before, I wrote a book about him, but it took me 9 years to write it. I was filling myself up with everything I could find on him. I knew I wanted to share that part of the journey, and I just couldn't find a way of telling his story. And then it occurred to me, what if I had a dinner with a Russian Orthodox hermit who knew Seraphim? And what if I told the story of our conversation? And as soon as that idea came into my mind, it took me 9 days to write my book, My Dinner with Anton, which was probably my biggest hit at that time. It was an incredible experience writing a book from cover to cover in 9 days. And when the publisher accepted it, I waited for the editing phase, and it was one typo. But that's unheard of. You don't write a book with only one typo and no editing phase. But it had just all come out in one hit. And really, My Dinner with Andre was the key that unlocked the telling of that story. And now I realize that My Dinner with Andre is a very old format, and that 2,500 years ago, Plato had really championed this way of teaching, where you turn it into a conversation, turn it into a dialogue. And so there's layer of stuff to get from My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah. I must hunt it out. I wonder whether it's available on Netflix or Amazon Prime or something, hidden, in the vaults.
It'll be somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah, definitely. So book number 7, The Dark Night, by Spanish mystic, Catholic saint, Carmelite friar and priest John of the Cross, published in 1584.
Yes, this was an amazing experience. I had never heard of St. John of the Cross when I picked this book off the shelf in my theological college library, but I recognized the title, The Dark Night of the Soul. I knew that title from having read Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I thought, if that phrase has become so much a part of our language, then presumably this book is a classic, so I'll read it. So I took it back to my room and I read it, and my jaw dropped. The depth of insight of this writer into human thought was incredible, and he seemed to be describing me personally in great detail. And I was very intrigued as to how somebody from another country, he was Spanish, from another century, writing in the 1500s, from another part of the church, he was a Roman Catholic, from another part of Christianity, he was a monk. All these differences between me and him, and yet he knew me in forensic detail, and he was describing my life back to me. So I was rooted to the spot as I read his book. And after about what I thought was an hour, I thought, I really need a cup of tea to help me process this. And I went into the kitchen and discovered I'd been reading for 6 hours straight. It had felt like an hour. So I thought, crumbs, it's midnight. I want to read a bit more, though, because this is fascinating. So I got my cup of tea. I'll read for another half hour, I thought. And after half an hour had gone, 3 hours in reality had passed, and I'd read the whole first half of the book, The Dark Night of the Senses. And I've never had a reading experience like that. I thought, I'll stop there, because I think this is as much as I can process. I'm going to be thinking about this for a long, long time. I'll come back to the second half another time. And it was inspiring to realize, I mean, he's called a doctor of the church, and I could see why, to realize that it's possible to have such a depth of insight that it transcends all those differences, that it could teach people centuries into the future. So that was inspiring. He got me to think very carefully about my own spiritual life and what I thought it was all about. So I really was wrestling with the material he'd given to me. But then the way he wrote was intriguing as well, because what happened was John of the Cross was around at the time of the Counter-Reformation, when the Roman Catholic Church was very nervous of anybody within its own ranks having any kind of following. So a great teacher was in perpetual danger of being burned at the stake if he got too popular. That was the politics of the day, and that was the world in which he existed. There were all sorts of wranglings among the monastic groups for preeminence and for wealth, really. And he got caught up in those conflicts and was buried in a hole in the ground for 3 months. And if that sounds impossible, well, actually, Europeans were doing that to their prisoners well into the 1800s. Papillon is about somebody who had that happen to him, buried in a hole in the ground. How was John of the Cross going to keep his sanity buried in that hole? He was going to write a poem. And so he wrote a poem. I say wrote, no pen and paper, had to memorize this poem. That was a poem about the journey of life. And when he got out, he had memorized his poem and then he wrote it down. And then The Dark Knight is the book he writes to explain what's in the poem. And that's a really fascinating way to write. To get information that is so dense that it has to come out as a poem, and then you take a long time to unpack it. There's something very, very profound in that. He had somehow tapped a well of truth by going into this very, very creative mode of writing poetry. And I've spoken to others who write music or who write poetry, who will say it's often that way, a bit like my experience of writing Dinner with Anton. They will get this download of a poem and they just write it out like that, almost like they're taking dictation. And then they'll stop and think, oh my goodness, what is this? And I think sometimes we do download information from a wider field of intelligence, a wider field of consciousness, without knowing necessarily that's what we're doing in the white heat of creativity. And then we go back and we say, well, what did I just write? And that's what St. John of the Cross did.
Wow. Is it still available?
Oh, it's been in print ever since.
Ever since. It
is a classic.
Yeah. I'll look that one up. Add it to my pile, which is growing by the week.
Oh, same here.
I thought I was well read until I started this book club. Now, it's like, oh my goodness. Okay, so book number 8, Eternity in Their Hearts, Startling Evidence of Belief in the One True God in Hundreds of Cultures Throughout the World by Don Richardson, published in 1980.
If I only had one book to recommend to my friends who are Christian believers, it would be this book. Now, this is my original copy, and you might be able to see it's very battered, but it is a hardback, so it has survived. That's what the writer looked like when he first wrote the book, Don Richardson. I picked up that book from the secondhand shelf again when I was at theological college. It's an absolute time bomb. It is written by a missionary, and that was very important to me because this wasn't written by someone who wasn't really into Christianity big time. This was somebody who had really given a huge chunk of his life and sacrificed a huge amount to be a missionary, to share the message of Jesus around the world. So this wasn't some faint heart or some academic thinking idle thoughts in his ivory tower. And he was a proper evangelical, and yet what's in that book is a theological time bomb for anyone reading it. What he does is gather together stories of remote people groups who, when the missionaries got there to tell them about Jesus, knew about 90% of what the missionary was going to tell them. And already knew because their own wisdom tradition, maybe going back thousands of years, and their own holy people and their own prophetic people, their witch doctor or traditional healer, already knew 90% of the material. And there are some amazing stories. The one that really stuck in my mind was let's call him a witch doctor. I don't know what his real name was. He was a traditional healer, the wise man of the tribe. Said that they were going to learn how to establish a better connection with God, the source of the cosmos, because one day a white donkey would lead them to a person who would give them the missing 10% of their information. And then he identified the white donkey one day, and the white donkey left their camp and started walking across the mountains. And so people followed the donkey to see where it was going, and it walked hours until it reached the missionary camp. And into the missionary camp it goes, right up to the well where the missionary guy was working. And so the people from the village say, "Hello, we've been led to you. You have something to tell us about connecting with God." And so he told them about Jesus. So at first you read stories like these as a young Christian and you think, oh, isn't God great? God loves everybody. He wants everyone to know about Jesus. He's more creative than I thought he was. And your vision of God expands a little bit. But then as you think through the implications of what you've just been told, and stories like that repeat in amazing, with amazing details from all around the world, what it actually does is completely blow up your us and them vision of the world. Because when I started reading the book, us was Christians who knew what was what, and everybody else needed bringing into our information in order to go to heaven. Because if they didn't, they'd go to hell. So this is my work, a heaven and hell world, a right and wrong world, Christian, non-Christian world. And the division point was exactly the same every time. This book very slowly and subtly blows all that up. This is not a world of us and them. This is not a heaven and hell story. This is not a God is with us and not with them story. This is a story about humanity, cosmic wisdom, cosmic source, cosmic contact, where I can learn from the remote tribal person just as much as he might be able to learn from me. And it takes you a while to realize that your neat and tidy us and them theology has been destroyed, but that book will do it. And it does it so beautifully. And it's written, you know, by an evangelical missionary. So you think you're on safe territory, and you are. It's full of truth, but it will open up your world in a wonderful way. And I think until you've had your theology blown up in that way, you can't really relate with genuine curiosity, openness, love, and respect towards other people, because you're always on the crusade. You're always the one in the right. And that book changed that for me.
So how old were you when you read it?
I think I must have been 27. Yeah, 26, 27 when I read it.
So how were you still a missionary yourself then?
Yeah, I was about to get ordained.
So
so I was about to become a missionary to the world.
How did that change things? Because suddenly it's like, what am I doing trying to convert people to my way of thinking?
It changed things gradually, but I think immediately it made me look for points of connection with people. Instead of assuming that everyone I was talking to had everything wrong, I would look for, what does this person know? What has this person experienced? And once you get rid of the heaven and hell framing of faith, and I did that also by a lot of my own study, going to the root meanings of words, as you mentioned before, that also changes how you talk about Jesus, because it's not about trying to get them into, I mean, with the heaven and hell thing, it's like you're in a pyramid sales scheme, and that's what your faith is. And every conversation, you're really trying to twist it around so you can get them into the scheme. Mm. But once you have realized the heaven and hell narrative is false and is not the gospel teaching, is not what Jesus taught, then you talk about Jesus in a far more open way. Here's something he said that I found really helpful, or that might illuminate what we're talking about. But I'm not trying to recruit you. I'm not trying to force you to join my thing, because actually you don't have to. And in fact, you might know a whole heap of this stuff better than I do, even if you have no faith at all. it just totally changes the shape of the relationship, where you can have a genuine interest in the other person and be willing to listen to what they have to say, thinking that you might have something to learn as well.
Yes, yes. You know, one of the most fascinating interviews I've ever done, I was doing a small series of interviews called Inside the Mind of God, where I was talking to different people, you know, with different belief systems. And I was introduced to, I think it was Lakota Sioux, an incredible teacher and leader and ancient cedar flute player who'd spoken, you know, to the United Nations. And his name was Teocasin Ghost Horse. What a beautiful name. And wow. And I asked him about God, you know, and he said to me, we have no name for that. He said, you know, and he was talking about how his people, you know, missionaries had come and thought they were all pagans and, you know, and needed to be brought into the whatever century it was. And he said, and they never, ever understood. We already knew. We knew far more than they knew. And, you know, the woods, the trees, the church, that was our God. He said, if you want to use that name. And he said, and then we had this conversation similar, you know, to what you've just been talking about, is that, you know, I just find this really frustrating, and I don't understand why people think that their job is to convince everyone else to believe what they believe.
Well, people have been taught and trained to read the teaching of Jesus in a particular way for a long time, and it can be quite hard work reading the Gospels and reading Jesus without reading it through the lenses of a lot of dogma. You know, a lot of people sort of assume the heaven and hell narrative before ever they start reading the Gospels, and then they read it in, but they don't realize that's what they're doing. Once you've read that in, it does distort everything and make it very difficult to have a more exploratory journey and a more open relationship with people. But what you just said, Sandy, is really profound about missionaries going and not recognizing the knowledge that's already there, and there being a disconnect because the local people didn't have a word for God. Don Richardson, who wrote this book, Eternity in Their Hearts, says the most important thing to do when you go to a people group is learn their language and learn their thought forms and really understand what they mean by their language. Because if you do that, you might find you never have to introduce the word God into the conversation because their concepts are actually perfectly adequate, maybe even deeper and more profound than your own terminology. So learn their language and you might learn a thing or two. That was his first step.
Well, this also, I mean, ties in again, there's a parallel in your book two of your Eden trilogy, where you were going around the world talking to all kinds of different people, cultures, indigenous tribes, elders, and finding that they all had the same stories, just different names for the characters, but they all had the same stories.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's a wonderful story I talk about him in The Scars of Eden and in Echoes of Eden, Francisco Jimenez. Now, he was a missionary. He was a Roman Catholic missionary and a Dominican friar, and he went to the parish of Chichicastenango in Guatemala. And he really exemplifies what Don Richardson talks about. He learned the local language and had a wonderful relationship of love and respect with the locals, to the point that they brought to him a text that had been buried for its protection for 200 years because all the other copies were burned when they had been invaded in the 1500s, and the priests had been executed. So this had been under really fierce protection, this book. But they entrusted it to him because they said, would you be interested to hear our story of beginnings? And he said, yes, I would. And he was so interested that he spent about 7 years translating it into Spanish. And it was a story with a totally different explanation of human origins. That's the Popol Vuh. And that book has been a tremendous gift to the world for anyone wanting to explore the history of the human race and get information that isn't in our mainstream, that we're not taught at school. That information only became available to the wider world because Francisco Jimenez was doing what Don Richardson taught, genuinely loving and respecting his hosts and listening to what they had to tell him.
Yeah. Well, we'll kind of come back to this a little bit later when we're finished with your 10 best, because I do want to talk about your books a little bit if we have time. Book number 9, Zen and the Birds of Appetite, Thomas Merton, 1968, one of the last books to be published before he died that year.
Yes. I had read a bit of Merton before, and again, I loved him for his simplicity. And then I found he'd written this book with this amazing title, which intrigued me. It was given to me by a friend of mine who said, I've read this. I want to know what you think of it, Paul. And it's layer on layer. So if I can remember correctly what had happened here, there was an amazing theologian in Germany in the 1300s called Meister Eckhart, who had written about ways of being that allow us to participate in what he called the divine energies, participate in what he called the Godhead. And as I read Meister Eckhart, I realized it was about an experiential connection with God, the source, something so real that it would transform your life. And he was not very well understood by the readers of that time, but he's been in print ever since because there's real power in that information. He's talking about a way of being, and he was described as a mystic. And then centuries later, a practitioner of Zen, who was a Buddhist, it was the writer Suzuki, had read Meister Eckhart and thought, oh my goodness, what Meister Eckhart is talking about is Zen consciousness. And so he wrote about Meister Eckhart. And then Thomas Merton came along and said, yes, Suzuki is right about Eckhart. So there are those three layers. And Merton is saying, yes, Zen consciousness really is talking about mystical consciousness and the way of being that Meister Eckhart was talking about. And so there's this amazing conversation where the mystics are meeting. And that was interesting for me because it introduced me to the reality that mystics across all kinds of traditions can meet and understand each other. They're having the same experience, but again, using different language. One uses the language of Buddhism. One uses the language of medieval Christianity. One uses the language of 20th century Christianity, Thomas Merton. But they're all describing the same experience. It's transgressing all those boundaries once again. There's no tribalism. There's no us and them. We are all trying to get to a more conscious state and a state where we are as alive as we can be and as flowing with the divine energies and divine wisdom as we can be, and we're all talking about the same thing and aspiring to the same thing. So that book was amazing to me because again it showed me that tribalism is just silly. We are all human beings aspiring to truth and to reality. And we can get there from any start point. And that's what I saw in that book. Thomas Merton argues it and explains it far better than I am able to. And it just struck me that that was one of Thomas Merton's last contributions to the world, alongside a little book called Contemplative Prayer, which is as simple as can possibly be. And again, Thomas Merton is a great example of someone who is very learned with a very refined intelligence and a very educated approach to faith, and yet he can write something that a child can understand. So that's what that did for me.
Book number 10, The Civil War, A Narrative by Shelby Foote, published in 1963. And you said that you were mesmerized by this award-winning ABC series. So it was a book and a TV series.
It was. The TV series, The American Civil War, was based on Shelby Foote's book. And I encountered it first as a TV series, in all honesty. And Shelby Foote was one of the main faces that you'd see in front of the camera. You'd see a lot of photographs from the era, Morgan Freeman's wonderful voice narrating the whole series before most of us knew who Morgan Freeman was. He was just this voice. Beautiful music. It was a real experience watching that series. I had no particular interest in the American Civil War, but I couldn't stop watching this series. It was so beautifully made. But every time Shelby Foote came on and spoke to the camera, it was like you were listening to someone who was there. He spoke about every character and every situation as if he had been there and he'd seen it and he'd heard this man say this thing. He had so internalized the whole story and the whole experience that you would sit at his feet with rapt attention saying, I want to hear from him because he must be one of the last people alive who was there. Of course, he wasn't, but that was his life as an academic. And once again, I thought, this is an incredible ability that he has, that he knows this material so well, he understands it, he has feelings about it, and he can internalize this whole thing to such an extent that it stops being dusty information from a dusty book off a dusty shelf to being something that is absolutely immediate and gripping. And I suppose I watched him and I thought, if he can do that and he's not a preacher, how much more should I be able to do that if I'm a preacher? And it made me realize once again that knowledge from the past doesn't have to sound dusty and boring and academic. It can be really arresting and exciting. And he just threw down a challenge to me as to where my studies would take me, whether it would just remain here or if it would go here and then change me to the point that I could share these other worlds with my hearers. And so he was like I never met him, but he was like a mentor to me as I sat watching him speak about his subject and saw what he had done with his subject matter.
So that is your 10 best books. Now I want to talk about you. Your books, Escaping from Eden, which was hailed by George Newey as this generation's Chariots of the Gods. Its internationally best-selling sequel, The Scars of Eden, which is endorsed by Eric von Daniken. And your latest book, Echoes of Eden, offers some truly explosive revelations about ancient stories from around the world and in the Old Testament, which describe entities that we would identify as ETs. Given what we know now about your 33-year ministry, your devotion before, the work that you've done, and these books, people might get the idea that you're an apostate, and you're not, are you?
Well, it's really up to other people to say whether or not they think I am. In my mind, no, absolutely I'm not, because my agenda is not to go out and debunk the Bible or debunk Christianity. My agenda is to understand the Bible and to drill down into the amazing information that has been curated by that book. And then a big part of my journey and it fits with what we were saying before, really, is listening to other traditions, other peoples, indigenous stories from all around the world, and realizing there are these extraordinary correlations, overlaps, and sometimes repeating stories that repeat in such detail that you know there is memory of something real that's being curated by these different people groups. And it was those overlaps that really got my attention, got me on the journey. But it's expanded my understanding of God. And it's, I think, improved my appreciation of Jesus. I've reframed my thinking on both, but both are still real centers of gravity, anchors to me in my worldview and my thinking. And what I find very interesting is that some religious believers will respond in that angry, you're an apostate, you've fallen away, you're luring people to the pit of hell, one person said to me one time, and many have said similar things. But the much larger number of people from a religious or Christian background have been people saying, thank you for breaking this taboo. Thank you for putting this on the table, because I'm a person of faith, but I've had this experience that doesn't fit in my understanding of my faith. Or I'm a person of faith, but I see things in the texts that we're not allowed to talk about. And so the busting of taboos can be polarizing, but the majority response I get from people is very, very affirming. I actually, last night, was surprised to have a message from a denominational leader, I won't say his name, but of a very significant Christian denomination, saying, I'm reading your books and loving them and agreeing with everything you're saying. And I think a lot of people in his denomination might be surprised to know that. But I think, you know, once again, it's that behind closed doors thing. Behind closed doors, a lot of religious teachers and Christian teachers in particular know a lot of the things I'm talking about in terms of the roots of the Bible, where the stories come from, what they're really about, but might not be in a place where they can talk to publicly about it, or just might not yet know how to filter that information into mainstream conversation. And I hope that my books help with that, because I think they do, because if you want to start a conversation, but you don't want to nail your colors to the mast, you can say, I've just read this fascinating book by Paul Wallace. See what you think about it. And then you can have a conversation and see what other people in the group think. And it's that slightly, it's a way of brokering that conversation. And I'm happy to play that role, to have some people laugh at me, ridicule me, or throw abuse at me, if it means there's now a conversation happening. About yes. paleo contact, about who yeah. we really are, where we've come from, what we're really capable of in the light yes. of these things, and then how that reframes our thinking about God and humanity.
So you're still a missionary, aren't you? You just got a different mission.
I realize I am. I think my mission is to learn, to find out what's what, and then to share what I find out. And that's yeah. really what I've done all the way through with all my books. This is the territory I'm on now. This is the subject matter. But it's kind of the same shape of ministry I've always had.
Well, your books, I mean, they, you know, I've read lots of books about contact. Your books are of a completely different ilk, and they come with so much credibility. So much research, you know, there's so much to back them up. And if I was recommending, you know, if somebody said, I want to know about ETs and, you know, what's the truth there, I'd say read these books rather than some others.
Oh, because thank you, Sandy.
you do a brilliant job. You really do a brilliant job. And if anyone watching this has not heard our We did three interviews, one on each book. You can find them on Times Radio. They're well worth listening to. They really are. So thank you for doing that. I have a couple of questions for you before you go. And these are nothing. They're completely unrelated to books. They're completely unrelated to anything that we've been talking about. But I'm doing some research for a new project. And so I'm asking a number of people, what would it take to secure the future of your children and grandchildren?
I think the most important thing I hope my children are learning from the life we're living together is the art of adaptation, because we can't control the environment in which we live. Now, the last couple of years has shown that to all of us. Can't control the environment at all kinds of levels, but certainly, you know, politically, economically, health emergencies, so on and so forth. And I think many of us have seen that our society can change shape very quickly and unpredictably. And I don't know what the world is going to look like by the time my children finish their lives. They are going to have to adapt to circumstances I might not be able to imagine. But if they have the wherewithal to adapt, to be able to say, how do I thrive in this environment? Have the wherewithal to decide how they understand things, what they think about things, and then have a way of carrying themselves that keeps them in every situation. I think that's the vital thing. And I think probably they've experienced enough so far in their lives with us as parents that they can see that adaptation is quite a useful skill to have under your belt. So I guess that all goes together with a sense of self, a sense of confidence, self-esteem, confident in your own thinking, and knowing that there are, you know, you can do things different ways. We can live this way, we can live that way. I think adaptation and the confidence to develop that is really fundamental.
Yes. If there was something you could do to foster that, you know, further than you have already as a parent, what might it be?
Well, so far we haven't had to think proactively about it because we've had to adapt to lots of changing circumstances as a family. So it's been kind of an object lesson. But I think encouraging curiosity is part of it. So I always encourage my kids with the questions they have, questions their teachers haven't been able to answer. Well, what do you think, Evie? Or what do you think, Ben? And to encourage them, well, I like the way you're thinking. I think you might have that right. Had you thought about this? I think the nurturing of curiosity is there. I think reading books is one way. I think I'm very happy for my kids to watch lots of movies, including in particular the Marvel Universe movies, because that's getting them into different worlds. And imaginatively, they're living in different worlds already because of their exposure to books and to film. So I think those experiences, if we had more money, I'd be taking them around the world to see different cultures and to have different experiences. And that was really my good fortune as a child growing up with my dad in the airline industry. We saw a lot of the world. We aren't able to replicate that, but in other ways, exposing my kids to other cultures has been really important. They've been very fortunate to be at a school where they have friends from other cultures that opens their world up a little bit and just shows them other, again, other ways of living, other possibilities.
You know, I think that's a really good answer to these questions, because we are living at a time, as you said, we're watching so much change. We can't depend on things being any particular way anymore. And I think that we need to be thinking about things like this because we are facing so many existential problems, you know, climate change and everything else that's happening. And I think that to teach our children to be adaptable and to be thinkers.
Definitely.
You know, to think.
I think probably all families are like this, but I think if you tell the stories of your grandparents and great-grandparents, that's another way of showing your children another world and other ways of being. And a few times I've told my kids about my gran and gramp's story of how they lived through the years of the Depression, where they lived in a little run of, I always get the number wrong, it was a number of houses that were semi-detached, about 10 households side by side with long strip gardens. And they all grew different things, different fruit, different vegetables. One had chickens, one had goats. One was very good at sort of mechanical engineering things. And they simply shared what they had through the years of the Depression. Mm. And that's how they got through. They used money only for a few things. And for a lot of things, they used what they got from the land. And that's very different to how most of us live. But it's very vivid for my kids because they know about my grandparents. They've heard that story. They've seen their pictures. They've seen the pictures of the houses where all that happened. And again, it's saying there are different ways of living to the ways we've lived so far that give you just another way of adapting to circumstances that means that you can thrive in a situation that could potentially be very challenging. And I happen to think that example is going to be important to more of us in the century ahead of us as things do shift, as structures do change. You know, if we have a war, then supply lines, it's going to become very relevant to us again. Self-sufficiency is going to become more important. And so I've been quite conscious about sowing some of those ideas in my kids' minds, just in case that's one of the things they have to adapt to.
Well, one of the things I've learned recently, my family, my brother, my daughter, and I have been dabbling with Ancestry.com, and we've been looking back at our family history, and we've been able to get, you know, a lot of information. We know where people were living. We know how many people were living in that building. We know all kinds of things, and that is an eye opener, because then you really begin to think about how differently they lived than we live now. And there's a great history lesson there for the kids.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. It's such a great gift, I think, Ancestry.com, because yes, the stories of our ancestors, they grip us in a particular way. Even kids get gripped by an understanding of who they are. They feel a certain pride and what their own ancestors did. And on the other side of my family, for instance, I only learned about my Ghanaian ancestry quite late in life because of a divorce way back in the 1930s. And I've been really happy reconnecting with that side of the family, learning the story. And so I told the story of my great-grandfather living in British Ghana and realizing that all the money was flowing to the people who owned the cocoa fields. And so top priority for him was to acquire cocoa fields. And it totally changed the life of that side of my family. And I like that story because that's something he did with future generations in mind. And perhaps it's something a lot of us have lost, to make decisions with our descendants in mind, not just me, not just my comfort, but what am I doing for my family seven generations from now? And I think all of us can find things like that in our ancestry. You know, the person who emigrated, the person who started a business, the person who moved from this part of the country to this part of the country, who made a change and started off a whole chain of events in the family history. It's inspiring to know these things. And then we think differently about what's possible for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could talk to you for hours, Paul. I'll have to pay you to come and talk to me. but we are out of time now. We've gone a little bit over. I want to thank you so much for adding your 10 best list to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's Library of Recommendations.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed the exercise of putting the list together.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad there was a reward in it for you.
Oh, for sure.
There's certainly a reward in it for us.
Thank you. Well, I look forward to our next conversation, Sandy. I really appreciate the time we spent together.
Ditto. That's it for this week. If you want to see any of the other episodes in this series, you can go over to the NoBSSpiritualBookClub.com, look at our video page. You can also sign up for a Save My Space and get last minute reminders of these episodes that are coming up. We have them every week on a Thursday, same time, and go over to the No BS Spiritual Book Club and have a look in the archive and find out who else has been contributing their 10 best lists. There's a lot of great people there. That's it. I'm Sandy Sedgebeer. I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me.